Before we begin, I would just like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land from which I am recording, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I acknowledge the elders past, present, and emerging. I would also like to acknowledge those with lived experience of mental ill health who are listening. I extend this to their carers, their clinicians, and their families who have supported them along the way. Over these last few years, many of us have had an introduction to the experience of loneliness. As we have been isolated from our regular routines, our families, our friends, our co-workers, baristas and bartenders, it is only normal for us to experience some form of loneliness. In this episode, I sat down with our world's first Minister for Loneliness, Tracy Crouch. Tracy was inducted in 2018 and was tasked with solving the loneliness epidemic that they saw folding out in the UK. Tracy's portfolio for loneliness was part of the legacy left from former Parliament member and advocate for loneliness, Joe Cox, who, as Tracy notes in this episode, was tragically murdered in 2016. As this is a mental health podcast, it is imperative I make the statement that loneliness is not a symptom of mental ill health. Instead, just like some other emotions, it can be a causing factor in developing mental illness. As I said before, I believe loneliness is an emotion we have all experienced to a degree these last few years. So it feels apt that as we're starting to resurface and re-enter our communities, routines, and workplaces, we gain further understanding into the experience of loneliness and how we can help ourselves and help others going through it. Thank you so much, Tracy, for joining me. It's so exciting to be chatting with you, having known about you and your position, world first position, for many years now. And it's really exciting to actually sit down across from you digitally and have a chat. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's really exciting.
So I guess to start off, before we jump into your position, this episode is about loneliness and the distinction between loneliness and mental health. So are you able to define for us what loneliness actually is and what's the effect on us as individuals, but also us in the broader sense of society?
Yeah, loneliness is a subjective emotion. It is something that we should all feel. It is a very human aspect of our lives, and it's part of our growth and our development. But the problem comes is when you feel acute levels of loneliness, and there is a significant health impact on people who suffer loneliness and isolation. And two are actually quite separate, but they are interlinked. And so what we found when we were doing the loneliness strategy was that the impact of loneliness is the equivalent of smoking cigarettes. And actually there's sort of kind of long-term consequence on health. The relationship that you end up having with your doctor is more significant than perhaps if you didn't feel those levels of loneliness. So loneliness and health are very much, related, but people shouldn't be afraid of feeling lonely because it is something that we naturally have.
Absolutely. I think that that's a really good disclaimer as well, because a lot of us, are chasing after the positives, or the grass is always greener and things like that. And I think previously it's been, around anger, the stigma around it, and that particular feeling that it's, it's a negative emotion or things like that. But to actually realize that we are individuals swimming in a sea of emotions, and it could be loneliness at one point, it could be anger, it could be happiness, sadness, grief, a whole bunch of things. I mean, Brené Brown recently has authored the book detailing, I think she said, 84 different human emotions, which, blows my mind, and I'm still yet to read it. But, to place loneliness within that and to know that this is something that we haven't acknowledged for so long. I guess that kind of perfectly leads into your position being the world's first Minister for Loneliness, or having held that position. And I remember I was on a plane headed to Canberra when I first heard about you and your position in 2018, just after you were appointed. And I could not get past, I told everyone I talked to that day that, the UK is so progressive in identifying this. What actually led to your position becoming solidified, and what did or does it entail?
I think it's really important to put the appointment into context, because when I got elected in 2010, I did actually talk about loneliness on a regular basis as a member of parliament. You know, it is something that we recognise in our own constituencies, particularly among the older community. And so I'd spoken about the issue of loneliness, as had other MPs. And then in 2015, we had a colleague join us from the Labour Party called Jo Cox, and she spoke about loneliness in a very different context. She talked about it in everyday terms. You know, she talked about her own personal experience as a new mum. She talked about it, in a sort of kind of very wider context, not just about something that afflicts older people. So she took the issue of loneliness and catapulted it into the stratosphere. And it became something that was much broader than, you know, grandma feeling a bit lonely because, you know, she's living at home and no one ever picks up the phone to talk to her. And then Jo was tragically murdered. And one of the things that sort of kind of came out of that was a real desire by a cross-party group of MPs to continue her legacy on the issue of loneliness. So a commission was set up to look at the issue. And one of the recommendations within that commission was to appoint a minister with responsibility for loneliness and to deliver a cross-government strategy on how to tackle loneliness. And I was already a minister in a department that had a brief to look across all other departments and collate sort of various issues into one part. And so I was appointed the minister, and it was I was very humble to be appointed it, because particularly because of the context and the background. So, you know, I think it was really exciting, but we worked really hard to make sure that we had the announcement made that, there was no sniggering in the British media about the appointment, and that we were going to have something tangible come from it. And that was the government strategy on how to tackle loneliness.
Yeah. I mean, when I sort of was looking into essentially this whole context, the Jo Cox situation really hit a heartstring. And I think that was really huge, like you said, for propelling this piece of work into sort of officiality and into something that was going to actually, something was going to come of it. When in this role, what were the biggest challenges that your strategy needed to address, given that there were, I guess there is still to an extent, predispositionings to stigma, and again, like you've noted, the consistency in measuring loneliness in different age groups and populations, but then also, like you alluded, the media and the way in which the media then reflects that as well.
Well, actually, on this occasion, the media were not a challenge at all. I think they completely got it. And the only negative comment I got was from the Stephen Colbert show in America. And I watched it, actually. And although he started sort of kind of joshing about it, by the end of his mucking around, he actually recognised that there was an issue. And I think, actually, because I think people can reflect, they can self-reflect. And the thing about loneliness is that it does impact everybody in different times of their lives. When we did the strategy, we actually put a map of our life. Going to university, losing a loved one, you know, all these things are really sort of kind of important parts. And it may well be the same actually in Australia, but, you know, we have a perception that there's going to be a greater level of loneliness in rural areas. Actually, there's a higher level in urban areas, and particularly in professional areas. We think that it's something that impacts on the older generation. And yet all our statistics show that 16 to 24-year-olds are more likely to be lonely than an over 65-year-old. And so I think even though Stephen Colbert started on this journey of taking the mickey, actually, I think he recognised that this is something that's not funny and it does impact on a lot of people. And it also impacts on people, you know, in high-level positions. You know, chief executives of major companies are exceptionally lonely. It's lonely at the top. Yeah, you've heard the phrase, yeah. Right? So, you know, I that's why there wasn't sort of kind of people mocking it in the British media, because I think there was a recognition that there was something, that there was a problem. And interestingly, it did get global reporting, as you yourself, you know, noticed it on a plane. And we had visits from ministers from New Zealand, from Japan, from Canada, from Scandinavia, from the UAE, you know, people who are really interested in the health impact, the actual statistical health impact, and, you know, what could be done to try and stop acute loneliness levels leading to significant health problems, which is where it gets costly. You know, you can make interventions at an early stage, connect people to communities, regardless of how big that community is, and that can reduce the level of cost to the health service.
It is such an interesting battle, isn't it? I mean, we see this same battle, you know, about sort of upfront paying that'll eventually save us money at the back end in things like mental health, in physical health, you know, like you were noting before, like smoking, for example. And it's absolutely baffling that, you know, we still haven't come to that point that sometimes we need to put out before we can get back, and what we reap is far greater than what we've sowed. It was really interesting when you were saying about sort of the age brackets that we often consider to be more lonely than others. And there was this great piece that was written, I can't remember who it was, but I was forwarded it on by my mother, who's studying sociology. And it was the fact that the younger generations are the most connected, socially connected generation to date, but they are also experiencing the highest rates of loneliness. And I mean, that was just huge to actually sort of comprehend and then to internally sort of process, which I think is really interesting. And again, we have the exact same problem when it comes to location-based loneliness. There is the conception that, you know, the smaller towns or the rural towns are more lonely, but they're far more connected in a community sense. And I come from a rural town and migrated to the city. Would do that all over again every other time. But it is so stark, and it is so hard to establish roots in a brand new city.
And I think it depends what kind of work you're doing as well, right? Because if you're a young person moving into a city from a rural location, very ambitious, you know, you're going to spend all the hours that, you know, you possibly can have in the office and then go back to your flat, you know, maybe by yourself, maybe living with somebody else, but and then you get up and do it all over again. And I don't know what it's like in Sydney, but
it's very much, you know, that.
Yeah, but here in London, particularly in the city of London, where all the financial institutions are, there is no weekend life, right? So if you're an office worker in the city, in a financial kind of institution, you know, you work all the hours, you do play hard as well, but you work hard, you play hard, but then at the weekend, there's nothing. You know, there's parts of London that are vibrant and everything else, but, you know, you wouldn't go out there necessarily by yourself,
yeah.
You know? And so if you're, it's a really weird place, whereas the connectivity in a rural community is more constant. And, you know, it's like, it's not the peaks and troughs that you have, you know, there's definitely a constant to it. You know, people get bored by that constant. you know, at the end of the day, it's very different.
Yeah, it is very. And I mean, you know, hearing stories about my grandmother who, you know, sort of moved to the town that I grew up in from another rural town way up north of New South Wales in Australia. And the way in which she was able to so seamlessly sort of become part of that community. And there really wasn't that, because I think there's an element of stakeholdership, and within a small community, there's more ability to be more interconnected. Whereas, like you were saying, like financial districts and certain job positions, they don't allow for that. Or there isn't much wiggle room around that. And I personally, I've definitely found that. I used to be in design, and there was such a thriving community, from sort of midweek drinks to pub lunches on Fridays to the infamous Friday night office drinks to sort of events and things that we all went to, and we all sort of did things on the weekends together as well, to moving to research, for example, where it is very siloed and it is very singular. I mean, I left work today because I was feeling I was the only one in the office, and I was like, oh, this is a bit lonely. I'm going to go home to my dog.
Well, I think COVID has really exposed and shone a spotlight on it. And just in your intro point, you pointed out about the connectivity of youngsters from a social perspective, but also from a digital perspective. And that is the case, you know, that I'm 47 this year, right? I grew up before the internet existed. I grew up before, you know, I didn't have a mobile phone until I was 18. And then that was a brand new thing. You know, I was the first generation at university to have an email address.
Oh my
right?
gosh, so, wow.
But the truth is, it means that the friendships were very personal. You know, they were real. Yeah, you know? And I can still, you know, I can't tell you my other half's telephone number, but I can still remember my best friend's telephone number from school, because you had to physically dial it. So, you know, there's a huge difference about it, but also your perception of who you should be and what you want to be is very different. And one of the things about the actual definition of loneliness is about the life that you have versus the life that you want. And, you know, that in turn can create that disconnect from a community, because you think you should have more. And while digital connectivity can be a solution for some people's loneliness, it can also be a cause of other people's. And the cause for 16 to 24-year-olds is potentially the digital connectivity. The solution for the over 65s is digital connectivity. So it's very, you know, it's a real sort of kind of interesting kind of paradox, if you like.
Mm. And I think, like you were saying, I think we have seen a lot of that flesh out in or during COVID through even things like telehealth, you know, the accessibility to services like that. Or I'm not sure if in the UK you have, I'm pretty sure I've read about it. Yeah, it was in your report. Like men's sheds, those sorts of situations, they went all online as well. Like little things like that, that previously would be considered like only a physical thing. And if you couldn't get to them, you couldn't get to them. Has enabled access for people with a whole range of things like agoraphobia and all sorts of stuff. When it comes to the linkages and sort of definite separations of mental health and loneliness, what is the differences and the misconceptions, I guess, between mental health and loneliness?
Yeah, I think it's really important to differentiate between the two. There is a connection, but they are not the same thing. Loneliness is not a mental health condition. It's a natural emotion. However, poor mental health can lead to loneliness, and loneliness can lead to poor mental health. So there is definitely a relationship, but they are not the same thing.
Mm. When you were just saying that, it kind of reminds me of that feeling depressed is a symptom of depression. You know, sort of that flatness or that depressed sort of emotional state arguably is its own emotion, but can lead to depression, a clinical depression or a depression diagnosis, which is, I don't think we really ever sort of separate the two generally when it comes to an emotion and its potential as an etiology for a disorder or a situation.
I've been through my own journey with depression, anxiety, and you know, I think as a consequence of that, I always try to be very careful with my own language. So, you know, I talk about being down rather than depressed, because actually I think, again, going back to the 82 different emotions or whatever, being down is perfectly fine. It's when it sort of kind of gets to its acute level. And I, you know, I think that's what we tried to talk about in the report. You know, that there are, you know, natural waves of loneliness. There's natural waves of poor mental well-being. But it's about sort of kind of resilience and coping strategies and, you know, connectivity and all those things to try and stop it from going to an acute level.
And that was incredibly evident as well. And, you know, absolute kudos to yourself and your team for writing that and the way that you wrote it to really distinguish the differences, and that mental health was arguably another player like physical health and things like that, where it wasn't seen as the sole driving force or it was encompassed within that. It very much was just another element that it can interrelate with, but is completely different from or separate from naturally, which I thought was really wonderful. Also really hard to find, you know, the crossovers when you're doing a word search and you're like, oh, no.
Yeah. It just keeps coming back. It's like a worm.
It is.
but it's, I'm really proud of the report. The report set out a really strong direction. And actually, you know, we have seen other nations look at the report and try and deliver their own loneliness strategy, because I think people have recognized that there is an impact on their communities. But there are some really simple solutions that are not particularly costly in order to try and connect people. And it is all about connectivity. We have a system here now, which has been developed since the loneliness strategy, of social prescribing. So instead of going to your doctor and getting a prescription for medication, you can go to your doctor and you can effectively be prescribed into a walking group, or you know, if you're an older person, into a men, you know, or into a men's shed, right? And our surgeries, not all of them, but a huge number now, have something called link workers. And they effectively signpost people into those services, into those groups. And that helps.
It does. And we know this from the fact that we are social beings. We, you know, very similar, I think I mentioned it a couple of episodes ago, very similar to elephants. We are innately social. And so, you know, when we remove ourselves or are removed from that, we are obviously going to experience ramifications of that and slews of emotions, which could be loneliness, it could be sort of sadness or being down, it could be longing, it could be so many things. And it's really interesting, actually, that you said that there's a social prescription, because we know from sort of a mental health perspective that social routine therapy is so pertinent when it comes to being able to become, like we were saying before, a stakeholder within our own communities, whether they be online, in person, whole city networks or tiny rural sort of networks. It's incredibly needed. And I actually heard the other day from one of our, they're called the ACT Health Network, and they're kind of like the primary health network of the local health district for Canberra and sort of some of their outlying areas. And they have this, a similar thing there called a green prescription. And it's to go out, go for a walk. It's to, you know, have 5 mindfulness minutes on a park bench in, you know, outdoors. It's those sorts of things, which is just so brilliant, but also so chafing to a lot of Western sort of ideologies as to what a prescription is. It is.
It's obvious. I mean, this is the thing that frustrates me. I mean, I'm a big advocate for well-being. You know, I believe that, you know, there are a couple of things that I really fundamentally believe are the solutions to everything in life, right? Show me a problem and somewhere this will be able to solve it. Sport, right? Sport and exercise and being outdoors in nature, right? And that will solve everything. I can't think of a problem that any of those things can't somehow resolve, right? To me, it's just like, you know, what, I don't understand why we're even having this conversation, right? It's just like, it's clear. You know, green therapy, blue therapy, which is anything by the water, you know, forest bathing, you know, mindfulness, i.e. sort of kind of, you know, obviously anything involving a breathing technique, you know, okay, that's not going to solve loneliness, you know, doing a meditation, but it does improve your own resilience.
Exactly.
So pet ownership is another thing, right? You said you left the office to come home to your dog. You now have some, you know, four-legged thing that is keeping you company, but actually you have to take that dog out and you'll meet other people with dogs. So there's a connection there. Your dog is making you make another connection. And so, you know, I just think that we have so much that we need to do. One of the things that we did put in the report relating to older people is about pet ownership, because unfortunately a lot of care homes here for older people don't allow pets to go with them.
Same here.
And it's just like, why?
Yeah.
what is a cat, you know, in some room that you're now confined to for the rest of your life? What harm is that going to do?
Who is it placing in any position to be a deterrent for overall health, let alone their own mental health and well-being? It is absolutely discombobulating when you talk about it from that perspective.
Well, companion animals are proven to improve mental well-being. There's been a great deal of research here about pet ownership, and the consequence on mental health. The physical act of stroking a cat, I can't remember the precise sort of kind of statistics, but physically stroking a cat can change your neurological process and make you feel better, which is why we have, things like patter dogs going into special education needs schools here, or schools with high need in other sort of kind of, you know, aspects. Patter dogs go into care homes, right? Because the physical act of stroking an animal releases, I don't know what it does, you know, it's not my, that's not my experience, but it releases
some
something.
Chemical.
Yeah, something that makes you feel better. So, you and I, we could just like make the world a much better place.
Look, through sport, four-legged friends and differing prescriptions, being green, social, blue, like the world cannot stop us, right?
No, exactly. I'm ready to take over the world from this end. You do it from down there.
Done. And I'm sure by the end we'll meet together in the middle.
We'll meet somewhere in the equator.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe somewhere tropical. That might be nice.
Yeah, I'll meet you in Bali.
Perfect. What have been some of the sort of the measured outcomes or the significant outcomes? You've mentioned things those individuals who place people in
link workers.
That's it. Yeah. I knew it had something to do with a pole and linking. don't ask me how. But what are some of the other outcomes or sort of products that have come from this report?
So the report was published in October 2018, and then I left government actually quite soon after. But I think there was good progress being made, and then COVID hit. And, you know, the pandemic just changed everything, not in terms of the recognition of the issue. And if anything, I think the pandemic helped with the conversation about loneliness. I think it probably reduced the stigma around loneliness. But where it didn't help was that there was a growth in terms of activity to tackling loneliness. And link workers are part of our national health system, and they were, you know, redirected into helping fight the pandemic and providing vaccinations, supporting surgeries in different ways. Of course, groups didn't meet, right? So your rambling group couldn't meet, your WI, your Women's Institute couldn't meet, your walking netball couldn't meet, you know, things like that. So unfortunately, I think that while the structural sort of kind of activity had got to a really good place, when it came to them being implemented, the pandemic struck and it was removed. However, I think now that we're kind of pretty much out the other side and all the restrictions are lifted here, that is gaining traction again. I as a local MP, do an event for the over 55s. It's like a freshers fair for older people. And you know,
can any younger people join?
No. You can go and do a stand, right?
Yeah, I'll do that.
But it's for the over 55s on purpose, because you know it's the nearing retirement, and or for those who have already retired. And it's about connecting people to hobby groups and activity groups, but also to vital services that they might not know that's been out there. We've had a significant amount of interest in either being an exhibitor at those things or from coming to them, because people are desperately keen to go out there again and to meet people again and to resume the lives that they had pre, you know, February 2020. And I think that, so those sorts of things are becoming really important now.
That's so great to hear about that. I think more people should take a leaf out of sort of your political sort of run, in the sense of what you've done in the varying positions, because like we were chatting just before, there is so much simple, so many simple things that we can implement within ourselves and those around us that will help us not negate the emotion, but navigate the emotion of loneliness, to destigmatize it, in the sense that we all feel it and we all will feel it from time to time, but we shouldn't have it. It shouldn't be affecting us in the rate that things like smoking does from a physical health standpoint.
I think part of it's about consciousness of other people as well. And, you know, we all get very aware of our older neighbours at Christmas time. And we all, like, go knock on a neighbour, check they're okay, you know, because they might not actually see anyone for 5 days. We had some research that showed us that people are more lonely in the summer because they've got all their windows open, right? And they can hear everyone in the gardens having fun, having barbecues, and they're sat there watching the TV because that's all they've got for company. And so, you know, I appreciate you're just going into winter, so maybe maybe the Barbies are being stopped. But, you know, it's like one of those things, just, you know, to think about is to invite a neighbor, right? Because they that might be the only connection that they have for weeks.
There was sort of that sort of FOMO element is huge, isn't it? When it comes to, I guess, any situation, but that's really interesting about summer and the fact that you can be so close to something and it's just out of reach, that sort of almost sort of glass perspective or imprisonment within your own home in that sense. And there was a gentleman who I was actually just thinking about the other day. A couple of years ago, I used to live opposite him in an apartment complex, and he would leave a new book on my doorstep for me to read, and in turn I would leave something for him, or I'd come in and I'd fix his DVR or things like that. And
that's just too cute.
It was so lovely. And I was thinking the other day that I need to drop a postcard in his mailbox to sort of see how he's doing. But I know that interaction between himself and myself, I'm sure, meant just as much as it did to him as it did to me. I gained so much belonging and importance, or self-importance in that sense, because I knew that there was that neighbor across the hall who, at the time, my four-legged friend was a puppy and would howl when I would leave. And he would come and stand at the door and howl back at the dog. So there were so many cute interactions within that sort of one living circumstance, but it was so easy to extend that hand, I guess, and it made me feel a lot less lonely, and I'm sure it made him equally.
Well, one of the recommendations we put in the report was volunteering. How can you help others, but how can you also make yourself feel less lonely? And volunteering as part of a befriending service was one of those things. And it's, again, it's proven that volunteering improves your well-being. For exactly that reason, right? Because you get something out of it as much as the person that you are helping or supporting. And that's a classic example. You did a sort of a pen pal type befriending service.
I know.
And it probably, right, when you came back and there was a parcel, it probably, you know, made you really excited. It was, you know, it's like receiving a letter from a loved one from afar, right? You didn't know when it was coming, and it was exciting. And I think, yeah, befriending services are huge and you know, really, really important in people's lives. Just picking up that phone and saying, hi, how are you? It's massively important.
Yeah. There's this show that aired on the ABC here, which documented, it was something like 6 or 12 weeks of these toddlers sort of roughly around the preschool age, that sort of 3 to 4 age group, coming into a nursing home and each week, same day each week, and interacting and building these relationships with these residents. And it was, you were crying out of pure joy and being from being touched. There was this one narrative of this woman who was so hard and so shelled over, and it sort of took a number of times, but then you could see that she came right out, and by the end of it, it was, she really missed them. And that, from that, it's starting to become something that is being implemented. Again, it's community-based and local parliament-based, but it's something that's starting to be implemented and sort of reflecting across the nation in those little moments, because that we all as a public got to see firsthand through documentation the impact it made. It was incredible.
I think, and these things are really important, and actually they do quite a lot of the intergenerational groups here as well, and the outcomes are absolutely lovely. We all get excited about, you know, reality TV when it's sort of kind of, you know, love at first sight and all that malarkey. But actually the things that really touch our hearts are those where that people are overcoming challenges in different ways. And there are so many, you know, different challenges that people face every day, and yet somehow there is a solution around connectivity. We had a similar reality show here called The Restaurant That Made Mistakes. And basically it was all people with Alzheimer's or severe learning disabilities, and they ran a restaurant. And there were parts of it that were hilarious, right? You know, someone with Alzheimer's taking an order, you know, and then by the time they got to the, you know, pass, they had no idea who it was for and things like that. But actually what was heartwarming was the connections that they made, the relationships that they made, and how they all became friends and they were all helping each other and supporting each other. And as a consequence, their own well-being was improved. And that's what it's all about. You know, this is about, you know, your podcast is about mental health and mental well-being, but, you know, mental well-being and physical well-being are very much linked, and loneliness can impact on both of those things.
Yeah, I mean, we experience emotion across both. And when you were saying that just before, because you also reap the reward and feel good, it was reminding me of that episode in Friends where Phoebe and Joey are having a sort of an episode-long argument that Phoebe was saying that there is no selfless deed, and Joey was like, yes, volunteering or doing this, and she goes, and then she
sort of rebuke him, and she'd be like, but don't you feel good after that? So you're getting something from that. And it was really for me, that sort of put in context the fact that there is an element of interest that we can all have within these positions of volunteering, and in opening a conversation with someone in an elevator, or talking that little bit more with the person at the front desk of your work or your apartment complex, like those tiny interactions, I know hugely help me in my daily life by walking first thing in the door of work and seeing Sheila, who mans the front desk, and we both smile at each other, ask how we've been, how, you know, what we're up to today, or if today's a daunting day. And the days when she's not there, I sorely miss her. I miss seeing that face when you walk in, and it makes you feel, again, that bit less lonely, and has that positive impact on our well-being, both mental and physical.
Completely. One of the things that we found here is that sole workers or lone workers, you know, actually suffer quite high levels of loneliness. And the Chancellor, who was Chancellor when I was doing this report, was particularly concerned about those kind of lone workers because of the impact on productivity. And he was thinking of things like Amazon delivery drivers, right? You know, they sit there in their van all day by themselves, just jumping out, knocking on a door, putting a parcel, and then jumping back in again. And you have a very different relationship with your Amazon delivery driver than you do with your postman. And, you know, your postman, you'll sit and have a long conversation with, or I certainly do. Whereas my Amazon delivery driver, you know, I just want him to give me my parcel and go again.
If I could ask one last question, what is one thing that you could do for someone and yourself? And I think we've talked about a number of these, but what is one thing that anyone can do here and now, tomorrow, today, to help sort of negate loneliness?
Well, I think it's making a connection with somebody. It is talking to somebody who is sat at a front desk. It is picking up the phone to your grandparent that you haven't spoken to for weeks on end. It is, you know, with everyone working from home at the moment, it's actually just having a phone conversation or trying to meet for a coffee in a park. Because, you know, the world has changed quite significantly since we wrote the report. Work from home has many advantages, but one of the disadvantages is the actual real life connections. So, you know, pick a work from home buddy and just say, hey, let's go for a coffee in the park at lunchtime, because that will improve your life, but it'll improve theirs as well.
That's so perfect. Thank you so much, Tracy. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you and feeling a whole range of emotions, not just, you know, loneliness in isolation, to pardon the pun.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
If you like this episode and you want to hear more, click the subscribe button. Feel free to even give us a rating or add a review. I would dearly love to see and hear your thoughts. If you're on Instagram, head over to The Informed, TheInformed. Just take out the E, where I post episode-related content each week.